Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between.
We've partnered with the Brain Tumor Charity, a cause that means a great deal to me personally. Thanks to our partnership, we've been able to create a short series of special podcasts uncovering those within the motorsport community who've been affected by these devastating diagnoses. You can hear my story, as well as the Williams Formula One team's planning director, Richard Jones, now with more to come. Also, bookings are now open for the Motormouth Charity Karting event, with places for the day now on general sale. Enter your team of four to an endurance race and compete with and against a host of motorsport celebs or pro drivers who will be drawn at random to be on your team. Gates open at 12:30 and close at 6 p.m. For all the information and to see who you could be up against, head to motormouthkartrace.com. We'll see you there, and together we can help every single person affected by a brain tumour. Without you and our sponsors, we wouldn't be able to carry on doing what we do, which is bringing you the biggest names in motorsport and delving into their lives and opinions. This season, we couldn't be happier to be teaming up with Devante Tires. What drives you? The pursuit of excellence never ends. You can now enjoy the thrill of the chase with Pro Tourer Sport from Devante Tires, featuring the latest innovations in tire technology, including intelligent water management and precision engineered interlocking tread blocks. Pro Tourer Sport has been designed from the ground up to enhance every aspect of your driving experience. Independently tested at Europe's toughest proving grounds by the most respected names in tire research, Pro Tourer Sport is at one with the driver. Ask your Devante dealer about Pro Tourer Sport today. Discover Pro Tourer Sport at devante-tires.com/Pro Tourer Sport.
Welcome to the Motormouth podcast. Now, today's guest has some impressive heritage. His dad was Rick Parfitt Sr. from Status Quo. And did you know that they were not always called Status Quo? The band was originally the Scorpions when they formed in 1962. A year later, they changed to the Spectres, then Traffic Jam in 67, before finally renaming themselves the Status Quo, before dropping the in 69 to become Status Quo for the 70s. Did you know that, Harry Benjamin?
I didn't know any of that, actually. So it's a great lesson for me. So I feel like we're in store for a sort of music/racing lesson for this episode, which I'm quite excited about.
I am,
you know,
as well.
That actually also apparently wasn't like a cerebral decision. Apparently they just saw it in a shoe.
Oh, well, there you go. He's piping up. I haven't even introduced him yet. You can't shut Rick Parfitt Jr. up, honestly. Shush.
Forget about it. I don't need to say anything. It's all the usual. Hair's growing out too long. I haven't done anything interesting. We'll skip that part. Let's move straight on.
Shall I introduce today's guest?
Oh, I think so.
I think you know who he is. So today's guest has to be one of the most diverse people we've had on the show. Not only is he a bona fide rock and roller, having played alongside the likes of Eric Clapton, Robert Plant, Brian Ferry, and He's a British GT champion, and he's only gone and landed himself a seat in the British Touring Car Championship alongside the great and good of British motorsport for 2021. We're delighted to have him here, Rick Parfitt Jr. Welcome, eventually, to the Motormouth podcast. How are you,
Rick,
doing?
I'd just like to apologise for Tim and his amateurish behaviour.
I've had too much coffee.
It's honestly been shocking.
Spandau Ballet. I can't say those words.
Spandau
Billet. So weird. Oh, Rick.
Yeah.
How are you? Let's take it way back. Now, you can't have had a very standard upbringing, I'd imagine. You're born into a rock and roll family. How do you look back and on those days and remember your very early years at home with your dad?
Blimey. Well, it was, I've always said this, right, that having a rock star as a father or someone in prominent is usually a two-edged sword. You know, like, you know, you get a lot of cool stuff that goes with it, but there's a lot of bad stuff that goes with it as well. And of course, my dad was every inch the rock star. And in those days as well, you know, there was no social media and everything else. You know, rock stars were proper rock stars. You know, I honestly think the musicians of today, in a good way, probably, you know, have learned from the mistakes of everyone in the past. And so he was every inch the rock star. And so, but with that obviously comes all the bad stuff, the drinking and the drugs and the women and everything else that goes with it. So, you know, a slightly chaotic upbringing, some might say. You know, but, and the whole juxtaposition of obviously my dad's come from, you know, playing working men's clubs and from like a council estate in Woking, you know, from Shearwater. So we came from very originally the East End of London. And so he was a proper Cockney and rhyming slang and all that sort of stuff. And of course, he sends me off to boarding school at the age of six. So I come home going, "Hello, Daddy." Marvellous. Surrey's great. You know? And he's like, "All right." And so, you know, Parents' Day at school was usually quite funny. You know, when all the sort of posho parents were there, and then my dad would sort of rock up, probably battered. You know. So yeah, it was interesting to say the least.
Well, with you, as you say, off at boarding school, were you around a lot? Were you around much of the music? Were you influenced by it growing up? You know, was it a first love, or were you a bit removed from it, actually?
Well, it's interesting you say this, because this ties in quite well. My first ever word was car, genuinely. So I was always obsessed. This was a great thing. Obviously, Dad had amazing cars, you know, and he was always a massive Porsche fan, as everyone knows, and he had loads of them, crashed pretty much every single one as well. But his moniker was that, you know, he always maintained he was a better driver than me because he'd never actually crashed a car while sober.
Fair.
So, I don't know how that works out, but, you know, that was his claim. So music, obviously, I loved as well. I mean, that was the good thing about when I was younger. We had a house which was... We had a sort of a studio in the house, like a live-in studio. So I'd come home at weekends and, you know, Marillion would be recording, or Level 42 would be recording, or, you know, with various people all the time just coming in and out of the house. And my mom is a mega cook, so everyone loved coming. So she'd like just cook all this food and stuff like that. So yeah, it was definitely kind of cool just to wander in. Of course, I'm oblivious. I'd always just wander in and say, "Does anyone want to come out and play some football?"
Pottering into your kitchen and there's Eric Clapton standing there having a cup of tea.
It's kind of a bit like that.
Yeah. So how on earth do you go from that and find yourself in motorsport? Where did that passion come from? Do you remember that being a thing when you were younger outside of your dad's love of Porsche and so on?
Yeah. I mean, we'd always go out for a drive, him and me, and apparently, you know, I'd sort of say, take over him, dad, is what apparently I would keep saying. And so I'd sort of lift myself up above the window and go like that as we overtook people. And he was, and Okay, let's go clangy for a second, okay? So Dad was very good mates with Roger Taylor from Queen, who lived down the road from us in Surrey. And Roger had a go-kart and a little figure of eight go-kart track down in the lower field at his house. And I remember one day I went over there and he just put me on this go-kart and I just left me. And I was there just going round and round and round and round until I couldn't reach the brakes, so nothing's changed. And, and I just kept on going until the petrol ran out. And then I think pretty much cried that he wouldn't put any more petrol in it because I would have just kept going until, you know. So that kind of started up, and I guess that's where the whole sort of love started. And then, you know, years later, I would spend all my pocket money going indoor karting until I got banned because I kept on winning at this place called Spitfire Karting in Feltham, and people would turn up and go, well, if he's racing, we're not racing anymore. So they were starting to lose revenue. So, you know, because I'd be there every weekend and I had, I think, over 100 trophies from this place. And they just went, look, sorry, you just can't do this anymore, you know. Yeah. So, which was great. And then I got asked to join their outdoor team. And so I went and I was quicker than them. And then I started my own team. And then I got spotted and I was a factory driver for Biz Karts for 7 years. Not a lot of people know, really.
Wow. I think it's one of the most unique stories, I think, that we, you know, all the racing drivers we have on here, it's a very typical route, you know, karting from the age of four and they make their way up and then eventually, you know, do they go off on tin pops or single seaters. Obviously, it wasn't quite like that for you, but were you watching motorsport as well, or were you just simply there for driving the thing?
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've always loved motorsport. I mean, Formula One was just a staple in our house, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're from Woking, you know, originally my family's from Woking.
Yeah, so McLaren,
my dad went to school, weirdly enough, with Ron Dennis. Can you believe
oh,
that?
Oh, wow.
You know? So, yeah, they went to the same school. And so there was that sort of knowing, we always had a strange link to McLaren, I guess. And, you know, we'd drive down when they were in like this row of, what could best be described as sort of huts, I guess, in those days, you know, like the sort of the World War II type of sort of, you know, prefab sort of stuff, and they'd roll the cars out and we'd always go and sort of drive down and go and see them rolling them out to try and catch a glimpse of them anyway.
Yeah.
And it was kind of funny because, you know, I went back, I nearly had a drive in a McLaren in 2019, I believe. And you know, I went down there and was walked around MTC and stuff like that. And then we went to their other workshop, and their other workshop is on the Shearwater estate. So when you come out the back door, you can see my grandmother's house.
Wow.
And I was going, I said, I'm just having a real moment here, you know, because that's where I used to play as a kid, just over there. You know, I could see, you know, the bit of grass that I used to, you know, just like ride my bike around on and stuff like that. So yeah, I've always got a really close fascination with F1 and particularly obviously McLaren, and and it's funny how it comes full circle that we actually played their big Christmas do in 2019 as well, before obviously the pandemic hit.
Amazing.
And so and Zach was very nice to me. He said, Rick, your home is at McLaren. Your home is McLaren. So I've definitely got some. So yeah, it was always on. We're always massive fans. You know, I think there's a really good documentary of when Dad and Roger actually went to Monaco. And they were trying to do a serious documentary and they're both absolutely hammered, you know, and the conversation could best be described as sort of stilted, you know, and these two, like, people just joking with each other. They're not getting any decent content out of it whatsoever. It's just hilarious. So, yeah, there you go.
Amazing.
There's no other way to be in Monaco, I don't think, if you're going to go.
if you're going to go to Monaco and you happen to be a rock star, you're going to have a nice time, aren't you? Before you started your British GT career, what was the gap there? Was there a gap, or was it literally karts, British GT, or what was in between?
No, I mean, a lot. You know, I stopped racing karts in about 2004. And then, you know, like with anyone, you know, I didn't have money to go into cars. You know, it was all of that was an absolute unachievable dream. You know, it was wonderful to be part. And I was working, you know, for Autosport magazine and Motorsport News. And I was selling ads, you know, that was my job, you know, and I was with Haymarket for 12 years. So I literally, before I went, I'm off to be a rock star. And they were like, of course you are, mate. See you in 6 months, you know. And luckily it worked out, thank Christ, you know, because I fully believed I would have been back. And but yeah, Haymarket was great. And so I was always surrounded by motorsport. And a lot of my friends were, you know, like, you know, Mark Hines, Christian Colby, Cacaldi, Dunbreck, you know, Darren Turner, all those. We were all sort of mates because, you know, we met through that world. And but no one would have assumed that I'd have gone into cars. So it was literally in 2010 where I was invited to come and do the celebrity. So yeah, obviously loosely termed, and obviously they'd run out of celebrities because they'd invited me.
Oh,
you know,
no.
The celebrity challenge at the Silverstone Classic in the Theatre Baths.
Yep,
you know.
Yep.
And Neil was there from Travis, who is a great peddler, as we know. You know. But I wasn't too much worried about the rest. So I qualified it on pole with Neil next to me, and we traded paint a bit. And but I went off and won it. And that sort of went, hang on a second. And, you know, by a little bit of a margin as well, you know. So I suddenly thought, you know, maybe there's something in this.
Yeah.
And, but then it was still the financial thing. You know, how am I going to find any money to go and do this?
And Rick, on the financial thing, I think a lot of people that are listening are probably thinking, well, hang on a minute. His dad is one of the greatest rock and roll stars of that generation. You know, surely there was money flying about. So presumably he didn't bankroll your career. He was very much like, you're on your own, you know, go out and make it happen.
Yeah, he's always been like that. Dad was never really... that sort of a dad in a way, you know. And I didn't see him for 10 years, don't forget, as well. Between what we were discussing then, I didn't actually see him for 10 years. I was with my mom and we had literally nothing, you know.
Oh, okay, so didn't know that.
I wasn't a kid that, you know, was like, you know, every tenner meant something, you know. And I was, but the juxtaposition was I was at this school where a lot of the kids were from wealthy families and they didn't have the worries that we had. And, you know, they'd be picked up in their limos and drivers and whatever, and my mum would potter in a Ford Orion, you know. And so I didn't really feel part of that because I wouldn't go out to the King's Road, I wouldn't go to the pub. And also I was recovering from my Crohn's in those days as well. I suffered Crohn's, so I was very, very thin and very, very self-conscious. And you know, I wouldn't go to the parties or anything like that because all the symptoms and everything that comes with Crohn's is really debilitating, so, you know, and embarrassing. And so I couldn't do all that world. But yeah, so when Dad came back into my life, you know, and we got on like a house on fire, we became very good friends, but he was never like that. There was never any money to go and do this. In fact, he was really against me going into music as well. And, you know, so I've had to always fight very, very hard to find the money. But the first break I was given was by Lawrence Tomlinson from Ginetta, who... we were actually, weirdly enough, at my birthday party in London, and I think alcohol played quite a major point in it, because he just went, happy birthday, Parf. And I said, what? He said, right, well, I'm going to put you in a car next year. So he said, just bring some money for crashing, you know. And I was like, oh, I don't need any money for that. Oh my God, you know. And so I think, you know, he saw it as a bit of a PR thing for Ginetta in those days, because it was early days. And so yeah, I sort of got in. And you know, I think people underestimated me a little bit, just this rock stars kid, you know, coming in. And so, and then obviously I started to do very well. I think on my second ever race in the wet, the old karting head came on and I passed everyone on the back of the grid, passed everyone into and got into the front of like some mega drivers in GT5, you know, but I've never led a race. And all of a sudden I'm at the front, like chasing's fine, right? You know, and, I was throwing it around and proper old karting. I used to love the wet. And I'm at front and I was like, oh, what do I do now? You know, and I literally, my glass was still going like this. I was steaming up going, I don't know what to do now. And I totally lost my cool and promptly spun.
Oh, you
know,
no.
And lost it. And I remember Lawrence came up to me and he went, you know, Parf, he went, that was the best race I've ever seen up until you spun. And I was just like, yeah, but I had no one to chase. I didn't know what to do. So, but after that, you know, I went, right, okay, I've got to give this a proper shot. So I was sponsored by a few friends, you know, begged, borrowed, stole, as you do. Well, not stole, obviously. yeah, I did a season in a proper season, even though I had to sit out two rounds because of gigging. Yeah, I got two lap records and, you know, was regularly on the podium. And that led to the going to GT4 the following year.
Yeah, well, you say you've had to fight for it, really. your whole life for this career. But in doing so, you kind of become a bit of a GT legend, really. So, as Tim likes to coin it.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, for those who can't see, Rick is sat in front of all of his gigantic trophies.
Actually, I'm not. There's some over there as well.
Not even all of them.
Let's not nitpick.
No. I mean, they don't fit in the frame, frankly. So, you've got to spread them around. I mean, we were joking before we started recording that, again, for those not listening, so as Rick sits to the right of him, there's a whole gaggle of trophies and a couple of model cars. To his left is what looks very much like a marijuana plant. So, you know, we've nailed this rock and roll racer thing. Yeah.
It's decorative.
Decorative only. Yeah. Well, we'll move on from that.
Can we just clarify that is not marijuana plant?
Just say no,
kids. Going out of people thinking that.
To all the PR and the communications people listening, it's not.
It's not even real. No.
let's not destroy his British touring car dream before it's begun.
Yeah.
So, can you imagine the first time I turn up, there's going to be testers there, straight away.
Oh dear! Well,
it's going immensely slowly. Yeah.
But he's having a great time.
Yeah, yeah. Are we out the pits yet?
Well, hopefully you will make it to the BTCC paddock. I'm sure you will. You've done well in the GT category, I'll say, in British GTs. Obviously, joined in 2011. You've been racing since then. It didn't take you long, really, to become champion, winning the GT4 title in debut year in class in 2013.
Yeah.
How did that feel? Because I suppose you've had success already in the build-up. You know you've got something there. But I suppose, was this the first proper, win, but, you know, a big championship, you're fighting alongside professional drivers who've done it for years. That must have been quite an immense feeling.
I can't tell you what it was like, you know. This is all plays into the part of the whole Crohn's thing where you have, whilst everyone thinks that I'm immensely confident and, you know, and like, hey, it's nothing's an issue. Crohn's makes you very insecure and hits you mentally, you know, and you carry all those scars through your life because it's like with any disability, you know, and motorsport brought me back to life. So this, to get into a car like that, a GT4, you know, 300 horsepower, a proper race car, and then to win and actually be a champion and be recognised for it, it was mind-blowing, genuinely mind-blowing, and I just couldn't believe it. It was an amazing moment, and also it silenced a lot of the doubters straight away, you know, and sort of really marked a sort of a turning point, you know, that people took me seriously from then on, and it was an amazing moment, and Ryan was great as well, my teammate. You know, we're very good mates now, and we chat a lot anyway. And it was just a great year. It just felt like we were against the world, you know. Yeah. And so to have done that, it was mind blowing, and to have Dad at Donny as well, when we actually crossed the line and won. There's some really good pictures of it, you know, we're also jumping around going, champion, and stuff like that.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
What did he say after seeing you win?
Yeah, no one realises, Dad was quite hard on me in a way. Like, he would never compliment, right? He'd never say the band was good. He'd never, if I played him some music, it was almost like, you see, this is the thing about rock stars as well, is that they are still essentially kids as well, you know? And because they've had this amazing life to a certain extent. And there's, I think with Dad, there was a lot of, you know, almost one-upmanship, you know, that if I said, oh, I've played there, yeah, well, I've played there too, you know, I'm like, well, it's not a competition, you know, so there was that little sort of competition, I think, between us, and, you know, so he found it tough to admit, but, you know, in the later years, you know, he really recognised, he thought our band was absolutely amazing, and he told me so, which was great, you know, and also from the car racing, I think he finally admitted that, you know, that I was probably slightly better than him, you know, so albeit sober, I think but he was never really, you know, overly
yeah
supportive or complimentary. It's just not what his thing. But to other people, apparently, so I'd always hear it third hand.
Yeah.
So that was good.
Yeah. So he was obviously very proud. He just didn't understand quite how to express it directly to you, which I think is the way a lot of parents are. You know,
exactly. Yeah. Everyone has parent issues.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not uncommon, is it, for parents to struggle to say that they're proud of their children as much as it is for children to say they're proud of their parents. And I think we've talked about it on here before when, you know, I'm terrible at saying I love you to my parents. Just totally useless. And we barely hug, you know, let alone outside of COVID times. I'm terrible at, you know, hugging them and showing I care, which is awful. But anyway, that's for another podcast where we lie down on a couch.
That's for Tim's therapy session.
Yeah. but while we're on a sort of serious subject, let's talk Crohn's before we go any further. This is a serious thing, and you've suffered terribly with Crohn's over the years, and I think you even had an operation. Like, was it last year or year before?
Yeah, perhaps? I'm up to nearly 30 ops now in my life.
So for
really major ones.
Yeah.
For
those that aren't up to speed with it, what is Crohn's disease?
It's essentially like an infection of the intestine. And what it does is it hacks away at the intestinal wall, it perforates it. Then that causes fistulas and a severe infection. It's all really nasty, and it gets all inflamed and then closes and literally blocks and dies. And the only way to get rid of it when it's at that stage is to chop it out. You know, there is no other way. And but what people don't realize is it's pain every single day. You know, you can't absorb, so you have chronic fatigue. You have to go to the loo, but you don't have time to think about it. You know, it can take you just like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you struggle to eat, you struggle to maintain a job because the pain is so bad, you know. And when the waves come, when you're in a flare-up, it's just horrific, because you just wait and you feel sick anyway. And then suddenly the waves come and it builds and it builds and it builds and it builds, and you're tensing, going, you're just tensing against it. And then it gets to this crest and you're like, to the point where you can't even bear it anymore. And then it just goes off like that, and you just feel like being sick. And then it comes again, and you can have that for days and weeks. And it's just absolutely—it's a horrific little thing.
Is there an awareness issue with Crohn's? Because I mean, it's not—I couldn't—I've heard of it, obviously, but I couldn't have told you what you've just said. I couldn't explain what it meant to have Crohn's. Is there enough awareness about this disease? Is that part of your sort of remit now, that you feel like you need to raise awareness of things like this?
Yeah, definitely. I'm an ambassador for Crohn's and Colitis UK, and with a couple of other really cool people. And but the awareness now is much better than it used to be. People, because it's seemingly an invisible illness.
Yeah.
This is also the problem, right? So bosses at work can't understand it. You know, they can't understand why someone's going to the loo 20 times a day. They can't understand why they're absolutely just cannot function, you know, why they're taking sick days. You know, they can't. So there is a bigger issue with this, you know, and also from the kids' side of it, you know, like when I had it, and you go through your teens, you know, and you're insecure. This is where you're forming your character, you know. So whatever happens in those days where you should be setting the world alight, and in your early 20s, you know, you should be right, this is what my ambition's going to be, this is what I want to do, and yet you're in hospital ripped up at 5.5 stone, you know, and you think, is this my life, you know? And so it's definitely getting much more awareness now. People are aware of it better than before, so that's a good thing.
Yeah.
So but it's like with a lot of invisible illnesses, people just need to understand a little bit. And what's nice is, you know, obviously I have to, the looks I get sometimes when I run to the disabled loos, you know, and stuff like that, because I have to, and I'm allowed to because of Crohn's. Obviously I've got virtually no gut left, and but the looks I get when I come out is sometimes it's awful, you know.
Yeah.
People just hear assume. Them making comments.
Mm.
And so what, there's been a big change as well on a lot of loos now. They say not all disabilities are visible, which is great. And that is a direct result of awareness of illnesses like mine. So that, you know, things like that. So yeah, we're getting there, but it's, you know, I there's so many illnesses and everyone has their cross to bear. So I'm definitely not saying woe is me. I feel very lucky. I've been able to create a life in two things that I absolutely adore doing. thanks to, you know, I've got a good team around me, particularly my wife, who is amazing and just puts up with all of this. In fact, to her, it doesn't mean anything. It's just me, yep. You know, and for that, that's why I knew that she was the one for me, because she didn't give a monkey's about my dad or my history or this, or I didn't have to put on this show to be someone special. You know, she's just a wonderful person. And so that was it. And to have her, you know, when I'm really struggling is just a wonderful thing. And I feel very, very lucky. So to be able to have this platform and the motorsport and to show that you can still, and to go out on stage in front of thousands of people, you know, I can still prove that, like, to people, if it helps a few people go, look, you know what, you can do it. If you want to do X or Y, just come on, let's do it.
Yeah.
And I communicate with a lot of people. I get a lot of messages from other sufferers, and, you know, so I will always take time to talk to them.
That's so good. And we'll certainly do our bit to push that message out through these podcasts when they're released, and snippets and so on. And if anyone is listening that happens to suffer from Crohn's, then get in touch with us, or, you know, get in touch with Rick. Yeah. Cool. It's important, and, you know, we do a lot of this sort of stuff around purpose, you know, and we're partnered with the Brain Tumor Charity, so we do a lot with them, and we've got, you know, plenty of very personal stories about it, as Harry well knows, because, you know, his family have been affected by it. So, you know, anything that can help using a platform, and, you know, if we can help with our little bit of the motorsport world to raise awareness of things like this, then we'll do it. So we'll certainly push the messaging out. Let's go back to racing. So you moved up to GT3, you graduated, you became a champion again in 2017, with Team Parker in that beautiful Bentley. So things are going pretty well at that point. Everything's looking pretty hunky-dory.
How's this one?
Oh, he's got it there.
Yeah,
that one.
It's a beast, isn't it? It's an awesome-looking car and very dominant. That must have been pretty cool, graduating up to that level of competition and winning again.
It was. I mean, to get the call, I mean, in 2016 was wicked, you know, and off Team Parker. And I've always wanted to race with Parkers anyway, because Stuart is a good mate of mine. And he said, we've got this kid and he's really quick, you know, called Seb. So we met up and we immediately got on. It was like I was his sort of older brother, you know. That, and the strange thing is, you know, he was this terribly annoyingly good looking chap with bit rock and roll, you know, as well. And you know, the girls just fell over in front of him. So I knew I had to just focus him a little bit, you know, just keep his eyes on. And you know what, and of course the other thing was the Bentley had a troubled sort of a GT3 launch to a certain extent. It hadn't exactly set the world alight. So no one really rated it or thought that we would be challengers, you know. And so when we turned up at Brands Hatch in 2016, and I stuck it on pole, and then Seb stuck it on pole, and then so aggregate, we were on pole, and we gave Bentley their first ever domestic GT pole. It was an amazing moment. I mean, honestly, there were tears in our eyes, you know, and there's videos online, you know. It was just amazing, an amazing moment. And then we were robbed in the race, right? So I stormed off at the beginning, and we had, I think, over 15 seconds lead. I was an absolute in such a rhythm, and I was just going, we've done it, we've won it. And then there was a crash, and they put this enforced yellow that they use in like artificial, so everyone had to press the button, you know, and apparently it neutralizes the race, but no one adhered to it except for us. So my 15 seconds was gone, you know, with everyone piling up behind me, and I'm like, how has that worked? Weirdly enough, it's never been in British GT since that day, so, you know, that's the way it is. But so we ended up finishing third, I think, or something like that, you know, because we got jumped in the pits. Anyway, so, to do that was great. And then we gave it its first ever win at Alton, which was amazing. And then we finished third in the first year, but people knew that we were perhaps a force once we'd ironed out the little rough edges. And then in 2017, we were hyper, hyper focused, and we knew what the strengths of the car were. We knew that it was better on long runs. It was good on its tyres. And we knew that we would struggle to ever win the sprint races, because the Lambos and everything just had better traction, and they were just great off the mark. But we knew that they used their tyres more than us. So we really hyper focused on trying to maximise the long distance races, you know, to our benefit, and because they're points and a half, so that would put, you know, so it was a real strategy to try and win a championship through thought process, as opposed to just winning everything, you know. And So yeah, that was an emotional year. I just lost Dad, you know, and so I was being hounded by the press, you know, when just before at Spa, you know, I was phoned up by the press and telling me, do you know how little money your father had and stuff like this? Literally just before I was getting in the car. And I was, it was mentally so tough. Luckily, Rach was keeping me very grounded. And Stuart, I was just like, what is going on? And I was really, it really hurt me. All the stuff that was going on, the stuff that was being said in the press from other Quo members and all this sort of stuff, it really hurt. And even my mum did a story, which is just atrocious. And, you know, it was a really tough time. You know, I've always tried to maintain my dignity and not say anything and just not do it. And that, to this day, that's not what I have. I haven't gone out to the press and said anything. And because I just wanted, I like my life as it is. And so Stuart was great. He said, listen, he just said, look, don't worry about anything. Don't talk to anyone. Just go between car and truck, you know, and said, and we will sort everything else out. And so he was, he's an amazing teammate, boss, you know, and friend on that year. And yeah, somehow we pulled it out of the bag, and that was, there's some pictures of me just going like that, you know, and I was like, that one's for you, mate. And it was a great year and brilliant to have delivered, you know, Bentley their first ever domestic title. And, you know, no one can take that away from me. So, you know, that's yeah, actually this one here, this is Bentley Am Driver of the Year, actually, weirdly enough. There you go. So, which I was 2 years on the trot as well. So yeah, it was really cool. And so I'm really proud of that era that we had. And, but yeah, it's time to move on.
Yeah. Mm. But can I just ask though, on the subject of trophies, what is that absolutely gigantic one in the middle?
This one.
Yeah.
That is the overall Drivers' Championship GT3.
Nice.
I've got two of those actually, because I was Pro-Am champion and overall champion, but there's an even bigger one here.
Oh, wow. It's out of shot. That's why.
God, be careful.
Massive. Oh my God. It really is.
That's like the Champions League.
Yeah. So, and that oddly enough is GT4.
It makes no sense.
So there you go.
A quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsor, Davanti Tyres. Actually, I'm not going to say anything. I'll leave it to six-time Olympic cycling champion and racing driver, Sir Chris Hoy.
Whether in my cycling or motorsport career, I'm always looking for that winning edge, the difference between ordinary and extraordinary. I'm Chris Hoy, and I choose Pro Tourer Sport, the new ultra high performance tyre from Davanti.
Racing is such a, obviously, quite a highly complex career. You've got to be focused, and as you say, you weren't going to win sprint races, you weren't going to get things on outright pace. So you were really having to dissect how you were going to beat people on track. So I suppose that must have been a huge help for you to have that focus.
Yeah, oh, definitely. You know, I remember on that year, you know, I was just saying to Seb, we cannot make mistakes. You know, we need to just tank points every single time. And we've got to think, if we're in fourth, we have a chance for third, but it's also a chance where we know he's going to close the door on us and risk those points. We need to tank points every round, because British GT is super competitive and it is super tight. And if you lose one round's points, you can pretty much write your championship off for the main part, you know?
Right.
And so we were hyper focused on trying to maximize every point from every single round, you know, and where the car wasn't great, do the best we can, you know, and where the car was great, make sure we nailed it, you know? And so it was, a really good year from that level. Yeah. And I guess, to be honest, that is how you win championships. You know, you don't just win
consistency.
Without outright speed. Yeah. Yeah.
It's consistently, you know, quick. Yeah.
I've always tried to be a little bit more of a thinker than an outright speed person, you know, and because it tends to pay benefits in the long run.
And now, obviously, things are about to get very interesting in your racing career, because, you know, like you say, it's time for something new, and you're going into the most competitive championship in the UK. British Touring Car Championship, really exciting, taking the wheel of the Accelerate with the number 8 in the name, clever. Motorsport, it's a Hyundai, right? i30N fastback, alongside some quality drivers and the likes of Ingram and Smiley. How did this opportunity come about? And it's got to be a little bit of nerves there, isn't there? This is big.
Oh, yeah, massive. Well, the opportunity came about is that I knew that, you know, from a sponsorship perspective as well, you know, that BTCC is a great platform, you know, and I've always been a massive fan of it, you know, from the days when I was working on the magazines, you know, and, you know, I watched, you know, Matt Neal win the Independence title and got given that check for $250,000 from Gao and stuff. And we're like, wow, this is amazing. Someone's beaten all the factory too, you know. So, you know, I've always had that love for the series. Yet again, it's another unachievable dream because the money to get into it is huge. Yeah. I mean, it's more than British GT. So, you know, it was always something that I never thought I'd be able to do. Yet when I got better and given the whole world COVID situation and the fact that music has been cancelled and that I'm not gigging at the moment or haven't in over a year, which is just nuts, you know. Mm-hmm. But it meant that I had time to commit to something as crazy as BTCC. Although it does look now the second half of the year, fingers crossed, I'll be back on stages again. In fact, we've just confirmed the first festival announcement is we're playing Marlow in September on Pub in the Park, Tom Kerridge's Pub in the Park.
Oh, amazing.
Supporting yeah. Ronan Keating. So that'll be fun. Oh. So that's come out. A good little plug there.
Yeah, well done.
And, but yeah, so it just meant that I had time and I had a bit of focus. And also, as with most musicians and probably a lot of people, I lost my sense of purpose, I think, you know, once the gigging stopped, because you go, well, what am I going to do? You know, I can't just hang around for ages, you know, and when is this going to end? So I gave myself sort of two focuses, which is one, to write an album, which is now pretty much done. The writing's done and we're producing it up, and hopefully we'll have something out in the summer with that, which is great. And I've surprised myself with that as well, to be honest, because I haven't written in years, you know, because you never have time. So it was great. Just every morning you get your cup of tea and you go down to the studio and think, okay, right, you know, you listen to some things which to give you a little bit of inspiration, you think, oh, I want to go sort of that route, and then you just go for it and you write. And so yeah, I'm 15 songs in and it's just great. And so there's that. And then also the other side was, you know, let's do this, let's try and get into BTCC, you know, I reckon we can do it. To be honest, it was a really close run thing, because whilst we had loads of people who were interested, because boards of directors are all on furlough or whatever, the decisions couldn't be made. And I think a lot of people have suffered from that, like yeah. where people go, yeah, we'd love to, but we can't get it across the line because the staff aren't in. We can't, and also, or they've made people redundant, which means absolutely the last thing you could be doing is sponsoring a race car. So there's a very finite amount of people who can still justify, you know, this is a marketing tool. So it was a close run thing. And I was talking to Power Max for a lot of time because I've known Plato for years as well. And, you know, we thought that would be the dream team, you know, me and Plato. You know, Parf and Plato would have been hilarious. Quite frankly, it would have been hilarious. I mean, quite frankly, if we'd have got any work done, it would have been incredible, right? But this was quite a lot of money as well. And weirdly, then I got a call from Tom Ingram, who said, look, one of your sponsors actually owns one of the companies that I'm sponsored by. And he said, I reckon there's actually a deal to be done to bring both across. And so it turned out that I went and I spoke to Justine, and they were great, and they really pushed the boat out to try and get me into the team as well on a deal front. And so that's how the deal came across. And it just turned out the fact that I wouldn't have had enough money to have gone to PMR, but I did have enough if I went to Accelerate. So it was circumstance. However, saying that, and PMR were just so gracious about it. Adam and Simon were just great. I mean, they really are gentlemen. So that was really nice of them, you know, because I was very honest. I said, look, I just don't have the money to run with you. I thought I did, but it's not happening.
Yeah.
And so obviously that's where I'm Accelerate. However, having now spent quite a lot of time chatting to Justina and them, you know, and all and Anthony at Accelerate, you know, they're a really ambitious team, as is shown. You know, they've merged with Trade Price Racing with Dan. You know, I'm getting a brand new car built, which I said is a bit of a waste in my first year. You know, seriously, give me the old one, because let's be honest, it's just going to end up in a wall. Right? You know? So, you know, but I'm getting a brand new car. It's amazing. And so it won't be new for long, obviously, being BTCC. But
that is exciting. With a brand new car, and I suppose, you know, not a brand new team, but a new journey for the teams as well. What can you realistically sort of set yourself? Where do you see yourself in the pack? Have you got a big goal that you want to achieve come the end of the year?
Yeah, I've said to all the fans, I've had an amazing response from the fans. You know, there's already a little group started called the Parf Army, which is
amazing.
We're in.
And you know, so there's apparently going to be banners. And I said, basically, I want, never before in the history of BTCC has mediocrity been celebrated so much, right? You know, so, you know, every time I finish a strong 23rd, I want everyone to give that signal. And,
yes.
Oh, me. You know, so my goal is to show, in all seriousness, you know, I joke, but I am actually quite serious about that. I'm not setting myself any expectations because this is everything I don't know. Okay, it's front wheel drive, it's circuits I don't know, it's lack of downforce, it's much less power, it's shifting, it's sprint racing, it's everything I don't know. I have so much to learn in a short space of time. So I think at the beginning, and to go to Thruxton as your first round, yeah, is quite daunting, to be honest. Let's be honest, in a front wheel drive car, which I don't know Thruxton either. So I don't know half the circuits, I don't know Thruxton, I don't know Croft, I don't know Knock Hill. I've never driven Brands Indy, but I've obviously driven the Grand Prix circuit a lot, so that shouldn't be too bad. Silverstone National, never driven that, so but it's one turn that's different from everything else, so I'll get used to that, that's fine. So I have a massive learning process, and I've set myself a goal, if I start at the back, just to work my way forwards. And if I can show that I've got clear progression, you know, in times and in competitiveness on the way forward, and if I can work my way into the top 15 by mid to end of season, you know, or get a couple of results in there, I think I would have done really well because, yeah, you know, you look at the names and the drivers that are in the series. I mean, they're amazing and they've been doing it for years. Mm. Everyone gets beaten up in their first year and everyone will want to beat me up. I've got a massive target on my back. You know, who do you think you are? This two-time champion, yeah, you know, and all that. I get that, right? And so I am very aware. I'm not going to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to be right in the mix from the start, you know, because the likelihood is I won't. What I can guarantee is I will put on a damn good show for everyone, yeah, and my elbows are well sharpened. And so it's almost back to the karting days, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, yeah.
You've got to get stuck in. You've got to get stuck in and
door-to-door racing.
I've just got to learn it all, learn what the other drivers are like, learn how their characteristics are, because in GTs you get to know the other drivers. You know when they'll give you room and you know when they won't, you know, and so I'm going up against a whole bunch of people who, a lot of them are friends, actually. I know a lot of the people on the grid, but, you know, racing's racing. So,
yeah,
we'll start at the back and
see where you go.
At the bottom, now I'm here. You know, that's what
I mean, it's going to be tough, isn't it? I mean, there are some legends on that grid. You know, Plato, you know, Matt Neal,
Sheddon.
Yeah. I mean, some of the names you're going up against are hardcore, and they're not going to give you an inch. You know, the likes of Matt Neal isn't going to, he is not going to care, you know, who you are. He's going to try and fight his way through. Just don't follow his lead and do silly tweets. I don't know if you saw his tweet, which just caused major problems when he I think it was either a football match or a rugby match, and he tweeted something about not wanting to listen to female commentators. And it was literally like, you know, I don't have any problem with them. I don't want to listen to a female commentator for 80 or 90 minutes. And Twitter just turned on him immediately. And you just think, what are you thinking? You know, you're a role model to so many people out there. And you've just single-handedly turned off a load of female followers. Like, what are you playing at?
It's funny though, isn't it? Twitter is such a vitriolic place.
Big time.
Over everything. And it's just, it polarizes that what social media in general, I just think polarizes. You can't ever be, you have to be one or the other, you know, and there's never a middle ground, I don't think. And it's sad really, because, you know, good things don't happen and bad things don't happen. And, you know, basically it's
a dangerous place.
I didn't know about that. But I've known Matt for years. And so, you know, and he seems like an absolute, I've only known him to be a lovely chap, so.
Yeah, I think people say things on Twitter sometimes that perhaps they wouldn't say in real life, and it's just a classic occasion where
put it this way, I'm pleased my dad didn't have Twitter.
Oh, it'd be a chaos. Can you imagine? It'd be absolute chaos.
I do think some people just tweet to provoke people, just to get that.
There is that as well, you know, so there's all these nuances, isn't there, with social media? And of course, the great thing is it's just in text, so you can never see whether it's
You can't get the tone right. You don't know what their tone is. Yeah.
So I think it's you know, my dad always used to say, steer clear of politics and religion in any interview. And you'd be all
right. Yes. So on that, so are you religious much? Or No, we're not going there. Don't worry. I do want to know, music and motorsport, two quite different things. I'm sure there's a lot of crossover and similarity, but how do you balance both? Do you find it difficult at times?
Yeah, there's no balance. It's just full on all the time, and which has been nice about this lockdown. For the first time in years, you know, I just got time to spend with Rach. You know, we woke up on a weekend and I'm not away gigging, and we just go for walks and do all the nice things that you want to do with your family, right? You know, and so that's been mega. You know, it's been really lovely, but it's already, the stress is creeping back up again, because dates are coming in. The whole BTCC thing is quite, there's so much to do, you know, and you know, making sponsors happy, putting the social media campaign in right for them, and meeting all of their goals and targets, and all of a sudden all these things, and then dealing with other people for gigs and riders and contracts and all this sort of stuff. And so she's starting to, you know, get swamped again. And so there isn't really a balance, unfortunately. It's just, you know, flat out all the time. But I approach both with the same attitude. Like, if anyone's seen my band, you know, when we go on stage, my band is super rehearsed. You know, it might look loose and rock and roll, but the fact is we are such a well-oiled machine, you know, and I've got some of the best session players in the UK. So, you know, my keyboard player has played with, you know, Lily Allen and he was in Wheatus originally.
Oh,
and,
wow. Amazing.
And I always play with countless other people. It's brilliant. And Amy McDonald and all this, and my drummer plays with Belinda Carlisle and Bonnie Tyler, and my guitarist is with ELO. So it's a seriously good band. But I don't let anyone sort of rest on their laurels. We are as good as we can be. And I include myself in that. If I haven't done my best, I'll beat myself up. And so, you know, every gig is, our motto is, every gig is if it's your last. Doesn't matter, big or small, does not matter. We will come on and give you the same amount of effort and show, which is 110%. It's exactly the same with motorsport. You know, if I finish last and I go, I've done the best I could possibly have done, then I'll be happy. But if I finish first and I know I left something on the table, I'll still be unhappy. I know, mad, isn't it? But, you know, it's a real sort of absolutely OCD, attention to detail. I have to do the best I possibly can. And so if anything goes wrong, you know, rest assured, whoever's watching, rest assured I'll be beating myself up more than you need to beat me up, basically.
Yeah. if you had to choose music or motorsport, which one would you take? What would you keep?
Difficult though, isn't it? Because there's a similar vibe. You're still performing on both levels. Do I have to choose one?
You have to pick one.
Okay. Well, there are both amazing highs, purely from the difficulty and the stress it takes to raise the money to go racing. I would probably then choose music, because that's, the destiny is in my hands rather than other people's hands. And it's only for that reason that I would choose music. And there is nothing greater than going on stage to a crowd who don't know who you are, flipping them.
Yeah.
And at the end, everyone's chanting and you're going off, you know, you're walking off stage to everyone chanting for you to come back on.
Yeah.
That is an amazing moment, you know, and I've been very lucky to do that. And I remember, you know, we headline quite a few sort of mid-sized festivals now, which is mad, over names, because people find it difficult to follow us, because we've got the luxury of being able to play whatever we want, you know, not the song, but just songs. And although we could do, you know, so my set, I call it set list science, you know, we're not just there to play our songs. So what our job is very different from other bands. Our job is to entertain the crowd. The crowd are the sixth member of our band. They just don't know it yet, you know? So our show is very energetic. It's right in your face. And what we do is just pull everyone in. We want everyone to be singing along, have their hands up in the air. And what you do with that is how you heighten the payoffs into certain songs, you know, where they go, what's coming next? No way, you know? So it's all a clever way of energy response and how you do that. So you don't just play song after song. You think how you can introduce it. And also it means that we can get away with a lot heavier stuff, which normally people wouldn't do in corporate world, because I've always believed it's just how you bring it to them or how you present it to them. So we're playing Metallica and Nirvana and stuff like that at corporate dudes, and they're all going nuts. You know, you've got Granny in the background, like, and it's great because if you do it with a smile and friendly and how you bring them in and make them feel part of something and included, then it works, you know, and that's kind of what we do. And so for that reason, I would say music, because there are more highs in music, I would say, than there are in motorsport. In motorsport, the old adage of 95% frustration, 5% elation is probably the truest thing that anyone said.
Right.
Absolutely. Now you've been in the game for a while now. You know, you're knocking on, Rick, let's be honest. Come on.
Massively.
We've got a lot of young people that listen to the show. You've created, you know, you've not had the financial support. You've had to create your own opportunities in life. What advice could you give to those who are just starting out on their career and thinking, you know, I've got a dream. I don't know how to get into it. I don't know how to pursue it. What would you say to them to make sure that they get a leg up?
It's like with everything, there's always going to be a lot of knockbacks, you know. Don't be disheartened. It's like, if you're passionate enough about it, like karting was everything to me. I was the most boring kid ever. My dad was like, can you stop talking about karting? You know, friends and family were like, can you stop talking about karting? It was all I talked about. I used to sort of go, I must go to sleep because I'm driving for 4 hours down to Clay Pigeon in the absolute pouring rain at 6 a.m. tomorrow. Yay! You know, it's that sort of passion. If you are truly passionate about motorsport or karting, you will make it happen. And if it means knocking on 1,000 doors, you only need one person to say, yeah, I will support you, you know, but you've got to knock on all of those doors to make that one person do that. If you knock on a few and they all say no and you give up, it's too easy to give up. Too easy to give up, you know. You've got to keep pushing, because if you have self-belief that you're good enough and you can do this, that's half the battle, because you will convince people. If people see the passion burning in your eyes and the real sheer want and determination, people will buy into that, you know. And you don't need to spend huge amounts to get going, you know. You can go to your local kart circuit, you know. You can just keep pushing. You'll get seen. I got spotted, you know. I ran one season as my own team, and then I had a drive where I didn't have to pay in karting for a long time, you know, which was great. And so just get yourself out there. It's the same with music as well. You've just got to keep plugging away, you know, and create your own little legend. And if you are good enough, cream will always rise to the top. But, you know, but what I'd also say is, you know, if perhaps you're not, you still have passion for the sport, and maybe, you know, just maybe you're not winning everything, you know. There are so many other avenues to go as well. That doesn't mean you don't have to be within the sport, you know. And as I've always said with music, it's like every kid is focused on getting to F1, right, you know. And if you don't get to F1, that's it. There isn't. GT drives are great, you know. You could be a brilliantly paid pro in GTs, you know. There's a whole wealth of different angles to go. You know, you can still be a factory driver, you know, in a different class. So never, don't think that F1 is the be all and end all. You know, there are so many other ways you can go. But also, if you're still passionate about it and you still gained all the knowledge, you could, and but you're driving, perhaps you're not the next Lewis Hamilton, and maybe you've come to that realization, you can still be. There are still amazing jobs. You could start a team, you know. I mean, you know, look at Christian Horner, you know.
Absolutely.
All these people are ex-drivers. Eddie Jordan, ex-driver. Christian Horner, ex-driver. You know, Toto, ex-driver. They've all realized, okay, we're not going to set the world alight, but we're good at this, you know. So find out what your strengths are, and, you know, whether it is driving or whether it's just being part of the team, and then just follow that route. Because what I've always said is, if you are passionate about something in life, you will make it work. It, you know, whether it's music or motorsport or anything else that you're passionate about. So, you know, that would be my advice.
Great advice. And I think one thing that stood out for me there that resonates, and you know, when I occasionally go on other podcasts and talk about careers and things like that, I think one thing you said there, which was create your own little legend, I think is quite an interesting point. Because, you know, one of the things that people, I think, struggle with who are very young and trying to make their way is how do I get noticed? You know, and if you make yourself a little legend in whatever it is that you're focusing on, you know, and that make that your absolute passion and goal until you create, you know, an aura around you that gets noticed and amplified, then you're going to get noticed and picked up and pushed on to the next thing. So a lot of that will resonate with people. So thank you for that. Excellent. Rick, we have three final questions, which we ask all of our guests. Harry, why don't you kick off with number one?
Yes, Rick, what has got you excited at this very moment?
Probably the prospect of a cup of tea after this.
Ooh, yeah.
Listen, as you said, I'm getting old, right? You know, I'm happy for small mercies. Think like a nice cup of tea. My dad would be so angry with me right now.
That's not very rock and roll.
Okay, let's give a proper answer. I'm excited about everything to do with BTCC, getting into a new paddock, meeting new people, new team, new engineer, and a completely new opportunity. It's exciting. I do feel like I've come to BTCC maybe 20 years too late because I'm 46 as opposed to 22, you know, and my sort of fear levels are probably not, are probably more heightened now than they were when I was 22. And also I'm excited about getting back on stages with the band this year. I'm very excited because it's been too long and I just can't wait to make people happy.
Yep.
Awesome. Number two, if you weren't a racing driver and you weren't a musician, what on earth would you have done?
Pilot.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Fighter pilot or commercial?
Yes. Fighter pilot. Top Gun, all the way. I've got the helmet. I should go and get it. I've got the Maverick helmet. Yes. That's how deep I am. I cannot wait for Top Gun 2. It's been delayed so long.
It's going to be amazing.
I'll be sitting on my sofa with the helmet on, you know, trying to... yeah. Fighter pilot.
That is a brilliant answer. Okay, final question for you though, Rick. What are you scared of?
Failure. Massively. Same with the band. I never want to fail. I don't want to fail. You know, I don't want to feel like I haven't done my best. Yeah. So yeah, that's it really.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty good driver, isn't it? To make sure you succeed, having a fear of not succeeding. Rick Parfitt.
But failure, but that doesn't mean finishing last is a failure. You know, it's about reaching what your expectations are.
Yeah.
If you can reach your expectations and go beyond them, then you haven't failed.
Yeah. Fantastic answer. And what a lovely 58 minutes we've spent with you. It's been brilliant to talk to you and hear about your career, your father, which is, you know, we're going to obviously interest a lot of people, your thoughts for young people, and obviously your music and your hugely exciting British touring car career, which is just getting going. So
everyone's like really fit. I've been seeing like Tilton's doing like running and stuff. I'm like,
You don't need to worry about that.
Listen, I've downloaded the Couch to 5K app. But that's as far as I've got. And I've had it for about a month now.
So you could do with maybe.
I can't handle seeing all these other race drivers going, hey, really good workout this morning. Can you go for a quick run? I'm like, oh. God.
I think you will win a lot of fans though like that. I think you will win a lot of support for that.
But saying that, listen, Tom is sponsored by Ginsters. We're Mullers in my team. You know, there's no way I'm not gonna fit in my suit by mid-season.
Oh, I love it. Well, listen, all the best with it. We're going to come and see you. I'm hopefully going to be at Thruxton. So I'll come and knock on your hospitality unit and demand to be let in.
Come and see Par Force One. Thank you, guys. I'm off for a run.
Enjoy your 5K. And Rick, thanks for joining us on the Motormouth podcast.
Thanks, guys. See you later.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out our sponsor, Devanti Tyres. What drives you? The pursuit of excellence never ends. Enjoy the thrill of the chase with Pro Tour Sport from Devanti Tyres. Pro Tour Sport is at one with the driver. Ask your Devanti dealer about Pro Tour Sport today. Discover Pro Tour Sport at Devanti-Tyres.com/ Protora Sports. Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth _, Instagram at Motormouth _ official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app, where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.